So, when we picture the front line of, a modern cybersecurity battlefield, we usually imagine these glowing screens in a dark room.
Right, like a movie hacker scene.
Exactly, like massive data centers, air-gapped networks guarded by, I don't know, biometric locks and armed security.
Yeah, the whole high-tech fortress threat model.
Right. But we certainly don't picture the dusty, blinking plastic box sitting next to the laundry detergent in your hallway closet.
No, we don't. But I mean, that is exactly where the front line is right now.
It's crazy.
It really is. We're dealing with this silent, multi-billion-dollar war, and it's being waged through the forgotten appliances in our living rooms. The data center just, well, it isn't the primary staging ground anymore. It's the home router.
Wow. Well, welcome to today's deep dive. This is your Cyber Mornings Daily Briefing.
Glad to be here.
We are bringing you a concise, high-impact look at the hidden architecture of everyday digital infrastructure. And so we're tracing a single massive threat vector today.
Yeah, starting from the incredibly granular level.
Right, like that forgotten router in your house. And we're going to follow that signal all the way up to the desperate legal measures governments are taking to fight it.
And finally, looking at the $37 billion corporate cybercrime syndicates that are actually pulling the strings.
Yeah, it's a fascinating and frankly, kind of an alarming trajectory.
Oh, absolutely. It begins with the anatomy of this highly stealthy new malware weaponizing those legacy home routers.
Which leads into unprecedented intelligence operations by Canadian spies, right? Literally reaching into civilian homes.
Yeah, and it caps off with a staggering new Interpol report that basically reframes how we need to think about transnational cybercrime altogether.
So let's just start with that dusty box in the closet. The threat intelligence team at Kiang Sin's X Lab just uncovered a new malware family.
Right, they've dubbed it Aerostinger.
Aerostinger, yeah. And they've found it infecting at least 4,300 legacy routers. And apparently that footprint is actively expanding.
Yeah, and legacy really is the operative word here. I mean,
Yeah.
Aerostinger is specifically hunting routers built on Realtek's RTL 8 1TiNex chips.
Okay, so how old are we talking?
Well, for context on the hardware timeline, this is silicon that was current between like roughly 2012 and 2015.
Wow, over a decade ago.
Exactly. The operators are exploiting ancient vulnerabilities, flaws from an entirely different era of the internet, basically.
The sources outline a few specific targets, right? Like they're hitting Linksys models using, let me check, CVE-2013-3307
Yep.
and D-Link models using CVE-2016-5681. And apparently the D-Link DIR850L makes up about 75% of the infected pool right now.
Which totally makes sense, considering how wildly popular that specific cylinder-shaped router was back then.
Oh, yeah, the one that looks like a little coffee maker.
That's the one. And they've also spotted a second highly sophisticated strain targeting QNAP network-attached storage, or NAS, drives.
Right. And the entry vector for those QNAP infections is, well, it's darkly ironic.
Oh, it really is.
The malware exploits a code injection flaw, CVE-2025-11127, inside QNAP's own malware remover tool.
Yeah. The tool designed to scan your drive and keep you safe is literally the exact door they are kicking in.
That is just wild. I'm assuming that because a malware remover fundamentally requires like root level privileges to quarantine bad files,
Right.
that compromising that specific tool just gives the attacker the absolute keys to the kingdom.
That's the exact mechanism. And that vulnerability was actually demonstrated at Puntuan, Ireland in late 2025.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, QNAP patched it in November of that year. But, you know, there is always a massive lag time before users actually update the firmware on a NAS drive sitting quietly in their basement.
Right. If it ain't broke, don't fix it from the consumer's perspective.
Exactly. And Aerostinger just lives inside that patching delta.
So normally mass router infections mean a brute force botnet. We're used to seeing millions of hijacked home connections leveraged to flood a target infrastructure with traffic.
Yeah, a traditional DDoS attack.
Right. But Aerostinger isn't doing that. If a DDoS attack is like using a hijacked house to throw rocks at a neighbor's windows, this feels completely different.
It does.
It's more like an attacker breaking into your house, not to throw rocks, but to set up a stealthy surveillance blind in your attic to watch the bank across the street.
That's a great way to put it. In the industry, we call that an operational relay box network, or an ORB.
Okay, an ORB.
Yeah. The operators behind Aerostinger have zero interest in crashing websites. They are entirely focused on the reconnaissance phase.
Like the stage of the attack that happens long before the actual intrusion.
Exactly. The compromised router becomes a footprinting node. It scans the internet, fingerprints services, enumerates subdomains, and tunnels traffic.
Because if you're an advanced state-sponsored attacker,
yeah,
you don't want the target's firewall to see your real IP address probing their defenses, right?
No, definitely not.
You want to look benign. By routing the reconnaissance traffic through a compromised D-Link router, it just looks like ordinary web traffic coming from a, you know, standard residential ISP in South Korea or Sweden.
Right. It completely anonymizes the attacker's footprint. And the engineering behind Aerostinger reflects a really deep understanding of their target hardware.
So
they maintain two distinct builds. There's a lean C build and a much heavier Go build.
Ah, because if they are hitting 12-year-old hardware, they can't be dropping heavy payloads.
Exactly. The memory and processing power on a 2012 Realtek chip would just tap out.
Right. The router would crash and the user would finally unplug the thing.
Which is why the C-Build is so lightweight.
Yeah.
It's deployed exclusively on those old routers and basically just sticks to passive mass DNS scanning and basic traffic tunneling.
And the Go-Build.
Well, if they compromise a modern QNAP-NS drive, which has, you know, significant processing overhead, they drop the Go build. That version is an absolute Swiss Army knife. It scans both internal and external networks, runs advanced reconnaissance tools natively, like fscan and HTTPX, and includes this script work task.
Meaning the attacker can execute custom Go, Java, or Python source code directly on the AS drive on the fly.
Yep. Without needing to compile a new binary for every single target.
That's terrifying.
And they obfuscate all the command and control communication, too. They use a basic math puzzle, an XOR cipher, to scramble the protobuf encoded traffic.
So standard security tools don't spot the malicious commands.
Exactly. Then they use gzip compression to shrink the payload down to practically nothing. It ensures it doesn't trigger out-of-memory errors on older devices.
Which brings us to the core unpatchable reality of this hardware. These legacy routers are officially end of life.
Yep.
They do not receive firmware updates anymore. If you have one of these boxes from 2015, you can't just click an update button in an app to fix a vulnerability discovered in 2016.
No, you can't.
You are fundamentally defenseless.
And because the consumer can't fix this, the burden is quietly shifting.
Right.
Intelligence agencies are looking at this massive, unpatchable attack surface, millions of abandoned devices forming a global sniper's nest, as you said, and realizing they have to start breaking into our homes to clean it up themselves.
That is a wildly aggressive shift in domestic intelligence. And it brings us right into our second story.
Yeah, the Canadian situation.
Yes. The Federal Court of Canada just released a redacted ruling from June 2026. A ruling that had been sealed for over 2 years, actually.
Wow.
It revealed that Canada's spy agency, CSIS, executed a first-of-its-kind threat reduction warrant.
Which really represents a watershed moment for how intelligence operates domestically.
Oh, for sure.
The operation targeted two foreign-run botnets that were executing a standard relay playbook, very similar to the ORBs we just discussed.
A foreign state was routing traffic through hijacked Canadian hardware to probe critical infrastructure, right?
Exactly. Specifically within the energy sector.
Hold on, though. We need to be crystal clear about what a threat reduction warrant actually means in practice.
Yeah, it's not just surveillance.
No. CSIS didn't just monitor traffic. They literally reached into servers, small office routers, and everyday Internet of Things devices.
Like Ring doorbells, smart TVs, security cameras.
Right, sitting inside civilian Canadian homes and businesses. And they altered, degraded, and destroyed the malware. They're secretly logging into a civilian smart doorbell.
It sounds like a movie.
It sounds incredibly illegal. If I remoted into my neighbor's TV to delete a file, I'd be looking at a felony.
You would be charged with computer mischief under Section 430 of Canada's Criminal Code.
Computer mischief?
Yep. The law doesn't care if you were deleting malware or family photos.
Yeah.
Unauthorized modification of data is a crime.
So how did they do it?
That was the legal hurdle CSIS faced. They needed judicial sign-off to legally commit computer mischief.
Wow.
Justice Catherine Kane granted the warrant originally in May 2024 because the court found the threat to Canada's critical infrastructure to be imminent and clearly established.
Okay, but the court made a very specific distinction to justify crossing that line, didn't they?
They did.
They emphasized that the operation targeted the devices, not the people. No user identities were sought, no private user content was intercepted, and any personal data swept up incidentally during the cleanup was immediately destroyed.
Right. It was positioned as a surgical strike. The agency sent commands to the malware, forcing it to uninstall itself or sever its connection to the command and control server,
leaving the rest of the device untouched.
Exactly.
We've seen similar cleanups in the United States recently, but the underlying legal authority is totally different.
Very different.
In late 2023 and early 2024, the FBI wiped the KV botnet malware, which was linked to China's Volt Typhoon, from hundreds of end-of-life Cisco and Netgear routers.
Right.
And weeks later, they did the same to Ubiquiti routers compromised by Russia's APT-28, but the U.S. used law enforcement powers.
They used traditional Rule 41 search and seizure warrants. The FBI and the Department of Justice were executing a criminal disruption.
Ah.
Canada used intelligence powers. CSIS is not a law enforcement agency. They don't arrest people.
So a threat reduction measure is completely different.
Yeah, it's a power designed to actively disrupt a national security threat on domestic soil, moving far beyond their traditional mandate of just, you know, passive intelligence collection.
But there is a glaring loose end in this public ruling that we have to talk about. The source material highlights that CSIS apparently relied on IP addresses they collected without a warrant to locate these infected civilian devices.
Yeah, that's a huge issue.
That seems highly contentious, considering that just weeks before this warrant application, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in RV Bykovets that an IP address carries a reasonable expectation of privacy under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
It is a massive legal contradiction.
Yeah.
I mean, how does a spy agency justify using warrantless IP addresses to target domestic homes immediately following a Supreme Court ruling explicitly protecting those addresses?
Right.
Furthermore, were the owners of these devices ever notified that CSIS broke into their hardware to delete foreign malware?
We don't know.
Exactly. The redacted ruling leaves those questions completely unanswered.
And practically speaking, this entire multi-million dollar, legally perilous intelligence operation is just a band-aid.
Absolutely. Because the underlying vulnerability remains untouched. CSIS or the FBI can reach in and delete the malicious payload.
But they do not patch the router.
No, they do not update the firmware on the smart TV. If a consumer simply unplugs their device to reboot it, or performs a factory reset,
that device is immediately exposed and vulnerable to reinfection the very next second.
Exactly. It's a temporary fix.
The sheer desperation of this is striking. Intelligence agencies don't risk constitutional crises over a decade-old D-Link router unless the alternative is catastrophic.
Right.
They wouldn't navigate this legal minefield unless the scale of the adversary was completely overwhelming.
And the alternative is catastrophic. Which brings us to the macroeconomic view of this threat landscape.
Yeah.
We've seen the granular device level, we've analyzed the domestic legal response, and now we really have to look at the global scale of the adversary driving this activity.
So we're pulling from the newly released Interpol 225-2026 Asia and South Pacific Cyber Threat Assessment Report. And the metrics here, they illustrate a total displacement of traditional crime into the digital sphere.
It's unbelievable.
In over half of Interpol's member countries in this region, cybercrime now accounts for at least 30% of all national crime.
The volume is staggering. Phishing remains the primary vector, with 5.5 out of every 1,000 individuals in the APAC region clicking malicious links monthly.
That's insane.
It's nearly double the global average. System intrusions now make up 80% of all data breaches.
Wow.
And we are seeing aggressive surges in DDoS attacks, up 92% year over year. Banking Trojans like Redline, Luma, and Lokibot have solidified their position as the second most prevalent threat globally.
But the evolution of the threat actors themselves is what really stands out to me. The mental model of the lone hacker in a hoodie drinking energy drinks in a basement that's dead.
Long dead.
We are talking about highly structured corporate syndicates. They operate exactly like multinational Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah, with the whole corporate structure.
Right. They have middle management, KPIs, QA testers for their malware, and they literally have forced labor HR departments for recruitment alongside AI research and development divisions.
The industrialization of cybercrime is the defining shift of this decade. The report details transnational organized crime syndicates operating massive, sprawling scam compounds, primarily located in Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and the Philippines.
So dark.
and the operational logistics rely heavily on human trafficking. They traffic individuals, trap them in these compounds, confiscate their passports, and just force them to carry out industrial-scale social engineering.
It's horrific. And they are aggressively weaponizing artificial intelligence to scale these operations. The report highlights the massive surge in romance baiting fueled by deepfakes.
Yeah, traditional romance scams are pig butchering required a massive amount of human labor. Scammers had to manually message targets for months to build emotional dependence before extracting fake investments.
Right, it was a long con.
But now they are using AI to automate that intimacy. They generate incredibly realistic AI personas, complete with deepfake video capabilities.
So if a victim gets suspicious.
Exactly. If a skeptical victim asks to hop on a video call to prove the person is real, the syndicate simply spins up a real-time deepfake that perfectly matches the persona's photos.
And they use the exact same technology to execute executive impersonation, right?
Hmm.
Tricking lower-level employees into authorizing massive fraudulent wire transfers by mimicking the voice and likeness of the CEO on a video conference.
Yep.
Interpol estimates that this specific AI-fueled scam vector drove $37 billion in regional losses. $37
billion. It's hard to even comprehend that number.
You are looking at the GDP of a small country generated entirely by AI-assisted fraud.
And as these syndicates become more corporate, their extortion tactics are becoming remarkably sophisticated. We're seeing a severe evolution in how ransomware operates.
How so?
Well, the traditional model was simple. Encrypt the data and demand a payout, or steal the data and threaten to leak it to the public.
But now they are weaponizing the regulatory compliance state against the victim.
Exactly. They breach a network, locate sensitive customer data, and then calculate the potential fines the company would face under frameworks like GDPR or the SEC's cybersecurity disclosure rules.
Oh, wow.
So the extortion demand essentially becomes, pay us the ransom or we will directly contact the government regulators and report your cybersecurity failures.
That significantly speeds up the extortion timeline. Usually they have to slowly leak data on the dark web to cause pain. Now, the threat of a massive regulatory audit and guaranteed government fines does the heavy lifting for them.
It's a brilliant, ruthless application of pressure.
It really is.
They understand the legal and compliance frameworks of their victims perfectly, and they use the very laws designed to protect consumers as leverage to maximize their payouts.
It is relentless. So bringing this all together for our Cyber Mornings Daily Briefing, what are the actionable takeaways from this massive flow of information?
We can distill this down to three core mandates.
Okay, number one, you have to retire your end-of-life hardware and immediately disable remote administration on any internet-facing device. As the sources made abundantly clear, a router that stopped getting security patches in 2016 is a permanent liability.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Number two, we need a fundamental paradigm shift in how we view our home networks.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that your everyday household appliances, your NAS drives, your smart TVs, your doorbell cameras are the new front line.
Yeah.
They are the reconnaissance nodes for advanced state-sponsored actors.
And number three, absolute zero trust regarding digital identities. With cybercrime evolving into a highly industrialized psychological weapon, you can no longer trust a voice on the phone or a face on a video call implicitly.
Not at all.
AI personas and real-time deepfakes are standard operational tools for these $37 billion syndicates.
Which leaves us with an uncomfortable but necessary question to consider.
What's that?
If the threat landscape is so severe that governments are now legally authorizing intelligence agencies to break into our vulnerable home devices for the sake of national security, how long before the dynamic shifts?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long before there is a legal or financial penalty for citizens who simply refuse to upgrade their ancient hardware, effectively leaving their digital front doors wide open for foreign adversaries to use as a staging ground?
That is the ultimate question. If your neglected, dusty router is harboring a state-sponsored reconnaissance network, at what point does your consumer negligence become a punishable national security liability?
Something to think about.
We will leave you to ponder that. Thank you for joining us for today's deep dive. Stay curious, stay secure, and maybe go check the back of that blinking plastic box next to your laundry detergent.
Good luck out there.
We'll see you next time.